Okay, and for tonight we have the reading of Carmilla by J. Sheridan Le Fanu from 1872. Prologue. Upon a paper attached to the narrative which follows, Dr. Hesselius has written a rather elaborate note, which he accompanies with a reference to his essay on the strange subject which the MS illuminates. This mysterious subject he treats in that essay with his usual learning and acumen, and with remarkable directness and condensation. It will form but one volume of the series of that extraordinary man's collected papers. As I publish the case in this volume simply to interest the laity, I shall forestall the intelligent lady who relates it in nothing, and after due consideration, I have determined, therefore, to abstain from presenting any precise of the learned doctor's reasoning, or extract from his statement on a subject which he describes as involving, not improbably, some of the profoundest arcana of our dual existence and its intermediates. I was anxious on discovering this paper to reopen the correspondence commenced by Dr. Hesselius so many years before with a person so clever and careful as his informant seems to have been. Much to my regret, however, I found that she had died in the interval. She, probably, could have added little to the narrative which she communicates in the following pages with, so far as I can pronounce, with such conscientious particularity. Chapter 1, An Early Fright. In Styria, we, though by no means magnificent people, inhabit a castle or schloss. A small income in that part of the world goes a great way. 800 or 900 a year does wonders. Scantily enough, ours would have answered among wealthy people at home. My father is English, and I bear an English name, although I never saw England, but here in this lonely and primitive place where everything is so marvelously cheap, I really don't see how ever so much more money would at all materially add to our comforts or even luxuries. My father was in the Austrian service and retired upon a pension and his patrimony, and purchased his feudal residence and the small estate on which it stands, a bargain. Nothing can be more picturesque or solitary. It stands on a slight eminence in a forest. The road, very old and narrow, passes in front of its drawbridge, never raised in my time, and its moat, stocked with perch and sailed over by many swans, and floating on its surface white fleets of water lilies. Overall, this slosh shows its many widowed front, its towers, and its Gothic chapel. The forest opens in an irregular and very picturesque glade before its gate, and at the right a steep Gothic bridge carries the road over a stream that winds in deep shadow through the wood. I have said that this is a very lonely place. Judge whether I say truth. Looking from the hall toward the road, the forest in which our castle stands extends 15 miles to the right and 12 to the left. The nearest inhabited village is about 7 of your English miles to the left. The nearest inhabited schloss of any historic associations is that of old General Spielsdorf, nearly 20 miles away to the right. I have said the nearest inhabited village because there is only 3 miles westward, that is to say, in the direction of General Spielsdorf's schloss, a ruined village with its quaint little church, now roofless, in the aisle of which are the moldering tombs of the proud family of Karnstein, now extinct, who once owned the equally desolate chateau, which in the thick of the forest overlooks the silent ruins of the town. Respecting the cause of the desertation, respecting the cause of the desertion of this striking and melancholy spot, there is a legend which I shall relate to you another time. I must tell you now how very small is the party who constitute the inhabitants of our castle. I don't include servants or those dependents who occupy rooms in the building attached to the Schloss. Listen and wonder, my father, who is the kindest man on earth but growing old, and I, at the date of my story, only 19, 8 years have passed since then. I and my father constituted the family at the Schloss. My mother, a Styrian lady, died in my infancy, but I had a good-natured governess who had been with me from, I might say, my infancy. I could not remember the time when her fat, benignant face was not a familiar picture in my memory. This was Madame Peridon, a native of Bern, whose care and good nature now in part supplied to me the loss of my mother, whom I do not even remember so early I lost her. She made a third at our little dinner party. There was a fourth, Mademoiselle de La Fontaine, a lady such as you term, I believe, a finishing governess. She spoke French and German, Madame Peridon, French and broken English, to which my father and I added English, which partly to prevent its becoming a lost language among us, and partly from patriotic motives, we spoke every day. The consequence was a babel at which strangers used to laugh, and which I shall make no attempt to reproduce in this narrative, and there were two or three young lady friends besides, pretty nearly of my own age, who were occasional visitors for longer or shorter terms, and these visits I sometimes returned. These were our regular social resources, but of course, there were chance visits from neighbors of only 5 or 6 leagues distance. My life was notwithstanding rather a solitary one, I can assure you. My governance had just so much control over me as you might conjecture such sage persons would have in the case of a rather spoiled girl, whose only parent allowed her pretty nearly her own way in everything. The first occurrence in my existence which produced a terrible impression upon my mind, which in fact has never been effaced, was one of the very earliest incidents of my life which I can recollect. Some people think it so trifling that it should not be recorded here. You will see, however, by and by why I mention it. The nursery, as it was called, though I had it all to myself, was a large room in the upper story of the castle with a steep oak roof. I can't have been more than 6 years old when one night I awoke, and looking round the room from my bed, I failed to see the nursery maid. Neither was my nurse there, and I thought myself alone. I was not frightened, for I was one of those happy children who are studiously kept in ignorance of ghost stories, of fairy tales, and of all such lore as makes us cover up our heads when the door cracks suddenly, or the flicker of an expiring candle makes the shadow of a bedpost dance upon the wall, near to our faces. I was vexed and insulted at finding myself, as I conceived, neglected, and I began to whimper, preparatory to a hearty bout of roaring, when, to my surprise, I saw a solemn but very pretty face looking at me from the side of the bed. It was that of a young lady who was kneeling with her hands under the coverlet. I looked at her with a kind of pleased wonder and ceased whimpering. She caressed me with her hands and lay down beside me on the bed and drew me towards her smiling. I immediately delightfully soothed. I felt immediately delightfully soothed and fell asleep again. I was wakened by a sensation as if two needles ran into my breast, very deep at the same moment, and cried loudly. The lady started back with her eyes fixed on me and then slipped down upon the floor, and, as I thought, hid herself under the bed. I was now for the first time frightened, and I yelled with all my might and main. Nurse, nursery maid, housekeeper, all came running in, and hearing my story, they made light of it, soothing me all they could meanwhile. But, child as I was, I could perceive that their faces were pale with an unwonted look of anxiety, and I saw them look under the bed, and all about the room, and peep under tables, and pluck open cupboards. And the housekeeper whispered to the nurse, "Lay your hand along that hollow in the bed. Someone did lie there. So sure as you did not, the place is still warm." I remember the nursery maid petting me, and all three examining my chest, where I told them I felt the puncture, and pronouncing that there was no sign visible that any such thing had happened to me. The housekeeper and the two other servants who were in charge of the nursery remained sitting up all night, and from that time a servant always sat up in the nursery until I was about 14. I was very nervous for a long time after this. A doctor was called in. He was pallid and elderly. How well I remember his long, saturnine face, slightly pitted with smallpox, and his chestnut wig. For a good while, every second day, he came and gave me medicine, which of course I hated. The morning after I saw this apparition, I was in a state of terror and could not bear to be left alone. Daylight, though it was, for a moment, I remember my father coming up and standing at the bedside and talking cheerfully and asking the nurse a number of questions and laughing very heartily at one of the answers and patting me on the shoulder and kissing me and telling me not to be frightened, that it was nothing but a dream and could not hurt me. But I was not comforted, for I knew the visit of the strange woman was not a dream and I was awfully frightened. I was a little consoled by the nursery maids assuring me that it was she who had come and looked at me and lain down beside me in the bed, and that I must have been half dreaming not to have known her face. But this, though supported by the nurse, did not quite satisfy me. I remembered in the course of that day a venerable old man in a black cassock coming into the room with the nurse and housekeeper and talking a little to them and very kindly to me. His face was very sweet and gentle, and he told me they were going to pray and joined my hands together and desired me to say softly while they were praying, "Lord, hear all good prayers for us for Jesus' sake." I think these were the very words, for I often repeated them to myself, and my nurse used for years to make me say them in my prayers. I remembered so well the thoughtful, sweet face of that white-haired old man in his black cassock, as he stood in that rude, lofty brown room with all the clumsy furniture of a fashion 300 years about him, and the scanty light entering its shadowy atmosphere through the small lattice. He kneeled in the three women with him, and he prayed aloud with an earnest, quavering voice for what appeared to me a long time. I forgot all my life preceding that event, and for some time after, it is all obscure also. But the scenes I have just described stand out vivid as the isolated pictures of the phantasmagoria surrounded by darkness. Chapter 2, A Guest. I am now going to tell you something so strange that it will require all your faith in my veracity to believe my story. It is not only true, nevertheless, but true of which I have been an eyewitness. It was a sweet summer evening, and my father asked me, as he sometimes did, to take a little ramble with him along that beautiful forest vista which I have mentioned as lying in front of the Schloss. General Spielsdorf cannot come to us so soon as I had hoped, said my father, as we pursued our walk. He was to have paid us a visit of some weeks, and we had expected his arrival next day. He was to have brought with him a young lady, his niece and ward, Mademoiselle Reinfeld, whom I had never seen, but whom I had heard described as a very charming girl, and in whose society I had promised myself many happy days. I was more disappointed than a young lady living in a town or a bustling neighborhood can possibly imagine. This visit and the new acquaintance it promised had furnished my daydream for many weeks. "And how soon does he come?" I asked. "Not till autumn, not for 2 months, I dare say," he answered. "And I am very glad now, dear, that you never knew Mademoiselle Reinfeld." "And why?" I asked, both mortified and curious. "Because the poor young lady is dead," he replied. "I quite forgot I had not told you, but you were not in the room when I received the general's letter this evening. I was very much shocked. General Spielsdorf had mentioned in his first letter, 6 or 7 weeks before, that she was not so well and as he would wish her, but there was nothing to suggest the remotest suspicion of danger. Here's the general's letter," he said, handing it to me. "I am afraid he is in great affliction. The letter appears to me to have been written very nearly in distraction." We sat down on a rude bench under a group of magnificent lime trees. The sun was setting with all its melancholy splendor behind the sylvan horizon, and the stream that flows beside our home and passes under the steep old bridge I have mentioned wound through many a group of noble trees almost at our feet, reflecting in its current the fading crimson of the sky. General Spielsdorf's letter was so extraordinary, so vehement, and in some places so self-contradictory, that I read it twice over, the second time aloud to my father, and was still unable to account for it, except by supposing that grief had unsettled his mind. It said, "I have lost my darling daughter, for as such I loved her. During the last days of dear Bertha's illness, I was not able to write to you. Before then, I had no idea of her danger. I have lost her, and now learn all too late. She died in the peace of innocence and in the glorious hope of a blessed futurity. The fiend who betrayed our infatuated hospitality has done it all. I thought I was receiving into my house innocence, gaiety, a charming companion for my lost Bertha. Heavens, what a fool I have been. I thank God my child died without a suspicion for the cause of her sufferings. She is gone without so much as conjecturing the nature of her illness, and the accursed passion of the agent of all this misery. I devote my remaining days to tracking and extinguishing a monster. I am told I may hope to accomplish my righteous and merciful purpose. At present, there scarcely a gleam of light to guide me. I curse my conceited incredulity, my despicable affectation of superiority, my blindness, my obstinacy. All too late. I cannot write or talk collectedly now. I am distracted. So soon as I shall have a little recovered, I mean to devote myself for a time to inquiry which may possibly lead me as far as Vienna, sometime in the autumn, 2 months hence, or early if I live. I will see you, that is, if you permit me. I will tell you all that I scarce dare put upon paper now. Farewell. Pray for me, dear friend. In these intelligent terms ended the strange letter. Though I had never seen Bertha Renfield, my eyes filled with tears at the sudden intelligence. I was startled as well as profoundly disappointed. The sun had now set, and it was twilight by the time I had returned the general's letter to my father. It was a soft, clear evening, and we loitered, speculating upon the possible meanings of the violent and incoherent sentences which I had just been reading. We had nearly a mile to walk before reaching the road that passes the Schloss in front, and by that time the moon was shining brilliantly. At the drawbridge we met Madame Perrodon and Mademoiselle de La Fontaine, who had come out without their bonnets to enjoy the exquisite moonlight. We heard their voices gabbling in animated dialogue as we approached. We joined them at the drawbridge and turned about to admire with them the beautiful scene. The glade through which we had just walked lay before us. At our left, the narrow road wound away under clumps of lordly trees and was lost to sight amid the thickening forest. At the right, the same road crosses the steep and picturesque bridge, near which stands a ruined tower, which once guarded that pass. And beyond the bridge, an abrupt eminence rises, covered with trees and showing in the shadow some gray ivy-clustered rocks. Over the sward and low grounds, a thin film of mist was stealing like smoke, marking the distances with a transparent veil, and here and there we could see the river faintly flashing in the moonlight. No softer, sweeter scene could be imagined. The news I had just heard made it melancholy, but nothing could disturb its character of profound serenity and the enchanted glory and vagueness of the prospect. My father, who enjoyed the picturesque, and I stood looking in silence over the expanse beneath us, the two good governesses standing a little way behind us, discoursed upon the scene and were eloquent upon the moon. Madame Perrodon was a fat, middle-aged, and romantic, and talked and sighed poetically. Mademoiselle de La Fontaine in right of her father, who was a German, assumed to be psychological, metaphysical, and something of a mystic, now declared that when the moon shone with a light so intense it was well known that it indicated a special spiritual activity. The effect of the full moon in such a state of brilliancy was manifold. It had acted on dreams, it acted on lunacy, it acted on nervous people, it had marvelous physical influence connected with life. Mademoiselle related that her cousin, who was mate of a merchant ship, having taken a nap on deck on such a night, lying on his back with his face full in the light on the moon, had wakened after a dream of an old woman clawing him by the cheek, with his features horribly drawn to one side, and his countenance had never quite recovered its equilibrium. The moon, this night, she said, is full of idyllic and magnetic influence, and see, when you look behind you at the front of the Schloss, how all its windows flashed and twinkle with that silvery splendor, as if unseen hands had lightened up the rooms to receive fairy guests. There are indolent styles of the spirits in which, indisposed to talk ourselves, the talk of others is pleasant to our listless ears, and I gazed on, pleased with the tinkle of the ladies' conversation. I have got into one of my moping moods tonight, said my father, after a silence, and quoting Shakespeare, whom, by the way of keeping up in our English, he used to read aloud. In truth, I know not why I am so sad. It wearies me. You say it wearies you. But how I got it, came by it, I forget the rest. But I feel as if some great misfortune were hanging over us. I suppose the poor German's afflicted letter has had something to do with it. At this moment, the unwonted sound of a carriage wheels and many hooves upon the road arrested our attention. They seemed to be approaching from the high ground overlooking the bridge, and very soon the equipage emerged from that point. Two horsemen first crossed the bridge, then came a carriage drawn by four horses, and two men rode behind. It seemed to be the traveling carriage of a person of rank, and we were all immediately absorbed in watching that very unusual spectacle. It became in a few moments greatly more interesting, for just as the carriage had passed the summit of the steep bridge, one of the leaders, taking fright, communicated his panic to the rest. And after a plunge or two, the whole team broke into a wild gallop together, and dashing between the horsemen who rode in front, came thundering along the road towards us with the speed of a hurricane. The excitement of the scene was made more painful by the clear, long-drawn screams of a female voice from the carriage window. We all advanced in curiosity and horror, me rather in silence, the rest with various ejaculations of terror. Our suspense did not last long. Just before he reached the castle drawbridge on the route they were coming, there stands by the roadside a magnificent lime tree. On the other stands an ancient stone cross, at sight of which the horse is now going at a pace that was perfectly frightful, swerved so as to bring the wheel over the projecting roots of the tree. I knew it was coming. I covered my eyes, unable to see it out, and turned my head away. At the same moment, I heard a cry from my lady friends, who had gone on a little. Curiosity opened my eyes, and I saw a scene of utter confusion. Two of the horses were on the ground. The carriage lay upon its side, with two wheels in the air. The men were busy removing the traces, and a lady with a commanding air and figure had got out and stood with clasped hands, raising the handkerchief that was in them every now and then to her eyes. Through the carriage door was now lifted a young lady who appeared to be lifeless. My dear old father was already beside the elder lady, with his hat in his hand, evidently tendering his aid and the resources of his Schloss. The lady did not appear to hear him or to have eyes for anything but the slender girl who was being placed against the slope of the bank. I approached. The young lady was apparently stunned, but she was certainly not dead. My father, who piqued himself on being something of a physician, had just had his fingers on her wrist and was assured the lady, who declared herself her mother, that her pulse, though faint and irregular, was undoubtedly still distinguishable. The lady clasped her hands and looked upward as if in a momentary transport of gratitude. But immediately she broke out again in that theatrical way which is, I believe, natural to some people. She was what is called a fine-looking woman for her time of life, and must have been handsome. She was tall but not thin, and dressed in black velvet, and looked rather pale, but with a proud and commanding countenance, though now agitated strangely. "Who was ever being so born to calamity?" I heard her say with clasped hands as I came up. "Here am I on a journey of life and death, and prosecuting which to lose an hour is possibly to lose all. My child will not have recovered sufficiently to resume her route, for who can say how long? I must leave her. I cannot, dare not delay. How far on, sir, can you tell, is the nearest village? I must leave her there, and shall not see my darling, or even hear of her till my return 3 months hence." I plucked my father by the coat and whispered earnestly in his ear, "Oh, Papa, pray ask her to let her stay with us. It would be so delightful. Do pray. If Madam will entrust her child to the care of my daughter and of her good governant, Madam Peridon, and permit her to remain as our guest under my charge until her return, it will confer distinction and an obligation upon us, and we shall treat her with all the care and devotion which so sacred a trust deserves. Cannot do that, sir. would be to task your kindness and chivalry too cruelly," said the lady distractedly. "It would, on the contrary, be to confer on us a very great kindness at the moment when we most need it. My daughter has just been disappointed by a cruel misfortune in a visit from which she had long anticipated a great deal of happiness. If you confide in this young lady to our care, it will be her best consolation. The nearest village on your route is distant, and it affords no such inn as you could think of placing your daughter at. You cannot allow her to continue her journey for any considerable distance without danger. If, as you say, you cannot suspend your journey, you must part with her tonight. And nowhere could you do so with more honest assurances of care and tenderness than here. There is something in this lady's air and appearance so distinguished and even imposing, and in her manner so engaging, as to impress one quite apart from the dignity of her equipage, with a conviction that she was a person of consequence. By this time the carriage was replaced in its upright position, and the horses quite tractable in the traces again. The lady threw on her daughter a glance which I fancied was not quite so affectionate as one might have anticipated from the beginning of the scene. Then she beckoned slightly to my father and withdrew two or three steps with him out of hearing, and talked to him with a fixed and stern countenance, not at all like that which with which she had hitherto spoken. I was filled with wonder that my father did not seem to perceive the change, and also unspeakably curious to learn what it could be that she was speaking, almost in his ear with so much earnestness and rapidity. 2 or 3 minutes at most, I think she remained thus employed. Then she turned, and a few steps brought her to where her daughter lay supported by Madame Perrodon. She kneeled beside her for a moment and whispered, as Madame supposed, a little benediction in her ear. Then, hastily kissing her, she stepped into her carriage. The door was closed. The footmen in stately liveries jumped up from behind. The outrider spurred on. The postilions cracked their whips. The horses plunged and broke suddenly into a furious canter that threatened soon again to become a gallop, and the carriage whirled away, followed at the same rapid pace by the two horsemen in the rear. Chapter 3, We Compare Notes. We followed the cortege with our eyes until it was swiftly lost to sight in the misty wood, and the very sound of the hooves and the wheels died away in the silent night air. Nothing remained to assure us that the adventure had been an illusion of a moment, but the young lady who, just at that moment, opened her eyes. I could not see her, for her face was turned from me. But she raised her head, evidently looking about her, and I heard a very sweet voice asking, complainingly, "Where is Mama?" "Our good Madame Perrodon," answered tenderly, and I added some comfortable assurances. I then heard her ask, "Where am I? What is this place?" And after that she said, "I don't see the carriage and Matska. Where is she?" Madame answered all her questions in so far as she understood them, and gradually the young lady remembered how the misadventure came about, and was glad to hear that no one in or in attendance on the carriage was hurt, and on learning that her mama had left her here till her return in about 3 months, she wept. I was going to add my consolations to those of Madame Perdon when Mademoiselle de La Fontaine placed her hand upon my arm, saying, "Don't approach. One at a time is as much as she can present. She can at present converse with. A very little excitement would possibly overpower her now. As soon as she is comfortably in bed, I thought I will run up to her room and see her." My father, in the meantime, had sent a servant on horseback for the physician, who lived about 2 leagues away, and a bedroom was being prepared for the young lady's reception. The stranger now rose and, leaning on Madame's arm, walked slowly over the drawbridge into the castle gate. In the hall, servants waited to receive her, and she was conducted forthwith to her room. The room we usually sat in, as our drawing room is long, having 4 windows that looked over the moat and drawbridge upon the forest scene I have just described. As it is furnished in old carved oak, with large carved cabinets, and the chairs are cushioned with crimson Utrecht velvet. The walls are covered with tapestry and surrounded with great gold frames, the figures being as large as life in ancient and very curious costume. And the subjects represented are hunting, hawking, and generally festive. It is not too stately to be extremely comfortable, and here we had our tea. For, with his usual patriotic leanings, he insisted that the national beverage should make its appearance regularly with our coffee and chocolate. And I think I'm going to call it here. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Bye.